Today on Pilot's Discretion, we're joined by Robert Sumwalt, former chairman of the NTSB and an experienced airline pilot. He tells us about the accident investigation process, why it's important to monitor flight path, and how to fix NOTAMs. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, pilots. I'm your host, John Zimmerman of Sporties, and thanks for listening. Remember to visit sporties.com/podcast for show links and complete archives, and send your comments to podcast@sporties.com. Today, I'm thrilled to have Robert Sumwalt on the podcast, a man who has done about as much as anyone over the last 25 years to improve aviation safety. He spent over 2 decades flying as an airline pilot and a corporate pilot. During that time, he accumulated more than 14,000 hours and also worked as an air safety representative for the Airline Pilots Association. Then in 2006, he joined the National Transportation Safety Board, where he served for 15 years, including 4 as chairman. He is the author of more than 100 articles and currently serves as the executive director of Embry-Riddle's Boeing Center for Aviation and Aerospace Safety. Robert, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
John, thank you. It's great to be with you.
We'll talk about aviation safety trends and specific recommendations, but let's begin with what drives that, specifically the accident investigation process, something you've been around most of your career. Why should we spend so much time on this? Why is it important to learn what went wrong? It's fair to say that's not the norm in every country.
Well, the real purpose of aircraft accident investigation is, frankly, to find out what happened so that we can prevent it from happening again. That's the main objective right there. Learn from it to keep it from happening again.
And some places around the world have a tendency sometimes to try to criminalize it. I think it's a noteworthy in the U.S. that we really don't. We take a real dispassionate look at the event and try to learn lessons. And it's worth pointing out that that's not necessarily the case everywhere.
Well, you're right. And I think once we start criminalizing it, then people will not be forthcoming and truthful with what happened. And so that's a real danger right there. So I think we do in the United States. We have a very good process, and I hope that we can continue to keep it that way.
That process, a lot of pilots, a lot of GA pilots read the NTSB reports. Many of them, especially for major accidents, are incredibly detailed. Exhibits and appendices and everything. But some pilots occasionally get frustrated that NTSB reports take so long to come out, or the NTSB doesn't speculate. They stay grounded in the facts. Explain, having been on both sides of this as a pilot and on the NTSB, why it's important to respect that process, or what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, I think you are right. I think that some of the reports were taking longer than they needed to, and I certainly made that point when I was the chairman. While I was the chairman, we put in place a mechanism, a process, a very detailed process-oriented approach to accident investigation, and we're seeing the benefits of it now. You'll notice that reports are coming out significantly quicker now. I think, though, it's important to always balance timeliness with quality. And yeah, you can complete an investigation in 30 days, but will it really have anything in it to prevent accidents? And so there's always that balance. And I never, even though I really wanted our investigations to be more timely, I really said to the investigators, it's got to take as long as it takes. I'm afraid, though, sometimes we had let process get in the way, and it did take much longer than necessary. But things are moving pretty well now that I'm gone. Things are moving pretty well.
The result of an accident investigation is sometimes a recommendation from the NTSB. It could be for technology, it could be for a procedural change, but it's up to the FAA or Congress usually to act on it. The NTSB doesn't really have the power to enforce that or write new rules. So in instances where a safety recommendation has not been implemented, what do you think are typically the barriers there? Is it political, technical, economic? Is it just inertia? What usually causes a recommendation not to happen?
I think in the case of other governmental agencies, it is the fact that, that it's a very bureaucratic process to get a recommendation implemented or to implement a rule, a new regulation, for example. And when we think about it, as citizens, nobody really wants the government telling us to do things that we don't really want to do. So our government has been set up through the Administrative Procedure Act to make sure that we don't have a heavy-handed government, that everything has to go through a very detailed rulemaking process. A notice of proposed rulemaking will come out. The public has the right to comment. Then the agency, if we're talking the FAA, then they have to be able to respond to those public comments and see if the rule is going to be not overly burdensome or if the benefit will exceed the cost. And that's another thing, is that the OMB does have to do a cost-benefit analysis to make sure that the benefit actually exceeds the benefit exceeds the cost. So yes, it seems like a very bureaucratic process. It is. It takes too long, but ultimately, I think we get to where we should be in terms of respecting that balance between the government just shoving something down our throats and actually putting in place a rule that that makes sense.
Is there an important win you can remember, maybe not even from your time, but where the NTSB has identified a problem, suggested a recommendation, it's been adopted, and it's been successful, and it's really changed aviation safety? Does one stick out to you?
Well, there have been many over the years, but you know, I like to use this example. It doesn't really apply to general aviation, but it was following TWA 800. The suspicion was, and the NTSB ultimately did find, that it was a fuel tank explosion due to an unknown ignition source. There was an idea. The NTSB came out with a bold recommendation about a year after that crash and said, we need a system of fuel tank inerting to keep these fuel tanks from being highly explosive. And so everybody said, oh, that could never happen. That's too expensive. Too detailed, it would add too much weight. But you know what? Necessity being the mother of invention, somebody actually figured out how we can inert these fuel tanks in commercial aircraft. And about 10 years later, the FAA was able to come out with a rule to say, from now on, any aircraft rule, any Part 25 aircraft, transport category airplane, will have to have a fuel tank inerting system. And people didn't believe that rule could actually be implemented effectively. And now all the airliners rolling off the production line do have that capability. And so I think that just shows that even though the rules may not, the recommendations not may not appear viable at the time, they ultimately do drive innovation.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. There's many examples of that, I think, that we take for granted now, maybe, but that began with an accident investigation. So how about looking forward? If you could snap your fingers and you're not on the board anymore, so you get to dream up anything you want. If you could mandate a change, technology, regulation, training, regardless of feasibility, what would be on the top of your wish list?
Well, I would go outside of the aviation industry just for a second and say that when we look at impaired driving, we're killing between 10 and 15,000 people each year on our highways due to impaired driving. A lot of that is alcohol impaired driving. So I would certainly put in place mechanisms to mitigate that. I mean, that's just absurd if we kill that many people in aviation. That shut aviation down. So I think that's an area that we need to really work on.
It's interesting. We had Bruce Landsberg on this podcast about a year ago, and he said the exact same thing, which I think should be a great non-aviation takeaway for everybody listening, that the NTSB is transportation, not just aviation, and they're really, really concerned about that distracted driving or the impaired driving. That's a big deal. So I want to ask you, as both a pilot and NTSB, when pilots read an NTSB report, you can get the quick reaction on YouTube in 24 hours usually, but when the actual report comes out, how should we read it? What's the right way to go through that? What mindset should we be in? What should we try to take away from it?
That's a really good question. You know, as ridiculous as some of these accidents appear, the tendency is to say, oh, I would never do that. And if you're saying, oh, I would never do that, I would suggest reading that report very carefully. And then there's never been one that I've read that I haven't said, somehow or another, I could not. Maybe I could have gotten myself in that same situation. So go into them with an open mind. Some people read them differently. Some people start with the findings and then the analysis. I'm not smart enough to figure out how to do it other than just starting at the beginning and going through the factual part, the analysis, the findings, the probable cause, and the recommendations. So however it works best for you, my only suggestion would be back to the first point. Go into it with an open mind and try and learn. There's a saying that I love, learn from the mistakes of others. You won't live long enough to make them all yourself. And I certainly believe that's true in aviation. Learn from the mistakes of others.
Great suggestion. A little humility goes a long way in aviation. Let's talk about some specific flying tips. You've written about the importance of pilots monitoring the airplane's flight path and the role that it's played in numerous accidents. So start by telling us what you mean by that, why that doesn't just mean pitch and bank, and then tell us why that's important.
Yeah, back in 1994, so we're going way back, the NTSB, and I was not at the NTSB then, the NTSB came out with a study of 37 flight crew-involved air carrier accidents, and they found that in 84% of those accidents, somebody was not properly monitoring or challenging what was going on in that cockpit. And I thought, my goodness, if we've got a bar chart that's really tall, that 84% of these accidents involved one factor, then that's a great place to work on, because if you can drive that down, then you're really making a sizable impact in safety. So I really got interested in that. I got some funding from NASA's Aviation Safety Reporting System to study that issue. And then I continued to follow that issue and study it. And we found that at the airline I was flying for, we did a LOSA, a line operations safety audit. And we found that most of the problems that our observers had seen out there on the line could have been prevented if pilots had been better monitoring. And I noted that with my own flying as well. Early in my flying career, I had, I think, two or three altitude deviations. I was brand new on the 727 and would be doing something other than monitoring. And the next thing I knew, I had flown through my assigned altitude. And it's not a good situation. So I learned that I developed techniques that I would follow that, for example, during the last 1,000 feet of the altitude change, I would only monitor to make sure the aircraft was going to level off, or I would not be reading a chart of, you know, while we're within 1,000 feet of altitude change. And so I started kind of doing a sort of a meta-analysis of how I could improve my own monitoring to make sure if I wasn't going to blow through an altitude or a course deviation or a runway incursion. And that led to revising an FAA advisory circular and other efforts. So really flight crew monitoring or flight path monitoring is making sure that you are actively monitoring where the airplane is pointed, whether you're on the ground for taxi or whether you're in flight. And that's really what it boils down to. And I want to emphasize the word actively monitor. We talk about a dog watching television. You know, a dog could sit there and just look at the TV, and he or she has no idea what they're looking at. And sometimes we can be that way in a cockpit. We can be just like a dog monitoring TV. We're just sitting there staring blankly at something, not really processing what the airplane is doing. And so I think it's important to mentally fly the aircraft, even if the autopilot, or if you're a two-pilot operation, even if the other pilot is flying, you've got to actively monitor and think about what it should be doing, and then making sure it is doing what it should be doing.
Such an important point there about actively monitoring. It's all too easy to fool yourself into thinking you're actually paying attention when you're not. I know I love that sterile cockpit within 1,000 feet of level off rule as well. I use the altitude alerter. So many airplanes now have some type of autopilot. even, light piston airplanes these days with the new Garmin autopilots and everything, you get that 1,000 feet away ding. And I use it VFR, IFR, doesn't matter. That's just a great reminder to me that it's time to pay attention, stop talking, make sure you know exactly where the airplane's going. Great habit to get into.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This all to me wraps into maybe a larger concept of professionalism, which is something else you've written a lot about. And I have a good idea of what that looks like on the flight deck of a 737, crew resource management, checklist discipline, follow the SOPs, all good. How about for general aviation? If I'm flying by myself or with a non-pilot passenger in a Cessna 182, what does professionalism look like for a single pilot operator?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm at Embry-Riddle now, and my primary job is not to be in the classroom, and we can talk more about that later, but I did happen to lecture to two classes yesterday. Say lecture, I don't mean literally lecture to these students, but I did speak yesterday to two classes on professionalism, and I'll do the same this evening at 6 o'clock tonight, because it is a topic that I saw. We saw way too many cases at the NTSB where there was a lack of professionalism. So let's go back to your question about what you can do. If you're flying a Cessna 172 or anything else, and I think that professionalism boils down to doing the right things even when no one is watching, and trying to be as precise with the aircraft control, to following the regulations and the rules, and just trying to do it the right way each and every time. Professionalism has absolutely nothing to do with somebody is being paid or not paid. So each and every flight, go out and practice professionalism. Do it as closely to the right way as you possibly can.
Something I tell new pilots sometimes is try to obey the spirit of the regulation or the SOP, not just the letter of it. So sometimes see pilots talking themselves into, well, this is technically probably legal. And I'll often say, well, is that what they meant when they wrote that rule, is to slide through a gray area, or should we respect the concept of fuel minimums or weather or whatever it might be? And that's sometimes just enough to make you pause.
I totally agree.
Is there a habit from the airlines that you think more GA pilots should adopt, whether it's training or CRM or flight proficiency, something we should shamelessly steal from the airline world that's worked?
Well, I do. There's so many things. I think all of those things that you just mentioned, let's go back to the sterile cockpit rule. A lot of times you're flying somebody that you're excited to be flying. They may be sitting right next to you in the right seat, and you want to show them everything. And I think it is important just to stay focused. During certain flight regimes, it's more important to stay focused. For example, taxiing. You don't want to be going out onto a runway that you're not supposed to be. So, what is the sterile cockpit? It is avoiding extraneous tasks while the airplane is under its own movement, under its own power for movement on the aircraft surface, or below 10,000 feet, unless that's your cruising altitude. And I think that's important. A lot of general aviation airplanes don't normally fly above 10,000 feet. So once you're at cruise altitude, that gives you a chance to sort of relax a little bit, relax the sterile cockpit idea. But, while you're climbing and descending, probably best to stay focused on making sure the airplane is at the right speed, right heading, course, and of course, that it is not going to go flying through your assigned altitude. So the sterile cockpit rule is so important, and it came about as a result of airline accidents where pilots were talking about everything under the sun except for flying the airplane or monitoring the flight path of the airplane.
Robert, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with some more questions.
Earn all your pilot ratings and keep your flying skills sharp with Sporty's Pilot Training Plus. This all-inclusive membership unlocks Sporty's complete library of award-winning video courses, so you can learn anywhere you have your phone, tablet, or laptop. For one annual fee, you get access to over $1,500 in courses, a smart investment in your flying career. Plus, enjoy free shipping every day of the year at Sporties.com. and apply for one of our three annual flight training scholarships. Learn more at sporties.com/pilot training. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We are back with Robert Sumwald, who spent a lot of time working on Flight Operational Quality Assurance, or FOQA, a system that monitors flights and tries to identify safety lapses before they become accidents. This is now a critical part of airline safety programs. You don't see it much in general aviation, even really in the corporate aviation world much. It's starting to appear there. Do you think this is one of those ideas we should steal from the Part 121 world and move towards general aviation? Can we adopt this as GA pilots?
Yeah, and I think let's dispel the myth that it is Big Brother looking over our shoulder. This can be a flight data monitoring program, can be very beneficial in a lot of settings. And people might even, if it's just you owning your own airplane, you might actually find it beneficial that you monitor your own flights, you record them somehow or another digitally. And then you go back and replay the flight and say, oh, my goodness, I had no idea I had gotten that slow on final. So, no, it's not a Big Brother looking over your shoulder. Even in the case of the airlines, it is not these programs are not used for punitive purposes. They're not even looked at generally to correct an individual's behavior. They're more to look at the system performance to see where systemic problems might be occurring on the line. So yes, I think there's a lot of merit to flight data monitoring programs. I'm convinced, as you just said, John, that airline safety, the safety record we have now, is partially due to the fact that airlines are looking at potential problems and correcting them before they become larger problems.
I think one of the topics I'd love to see general aviation pilots adopt more is the concept of the flight debrief. I think we've beaten it at everybody's heads about the pre-flight briefing and look at the weather and do your performance calculations, which is good, but not enough pilots do that debrief. And there are digital tools now, ForeFlight, Cloud Ahoy, these programs that make it pretty easy to debrief your flight. And it's not in a subjective, oh, I think I did pretty good sense. It's in a very objective, your airspeed was all over the place on final, or you leveled off 200 feet too high. I think that can take some of the emotion out of the debrief by using those tools. So I'm with you on that. Speaking of airlines and catching safety lapses, there's certainly been a number of headlines about that over the last year. Some of them have been a little bit over the top, but some of them have not. There've been some scary ones, including some runway incursions. You wrote not that long ago, quote, an easy explanation, one that I've heard several times over the past few weeks, is that the aviation industry is coming out of the pandemic and the workforce is a bit rusty. I don't buy it, end quote. So what do you think the real cause is? Why have we had so many of these close calls, or is this all just statistical noise?
Yeah, I do think that's sort of an easy explanation. I do think in the case of air traffic controllers, that they are way behind with hiring. And I'm on this FAA independent review team, safety review team, and we're certainly looking at that. So I think it's fair to say that ATC, they are behind in hiring, which was a result of many things, including the pandemic. But I think I'm still scratching my head along with other people as far as what is the underlying issues in each of these events that we saw earlier in the year. Runway incursions, scary flight coming out of Maui on an air carrier in December. Is there a one underlying issue? I doubt it. I'm sort of the opinion that this may be statistical noise that normally in a longer period of time you would see these events occurring, but they would be. They would be spread out over a period of time, whereas here we had several in January and February, which got a lot of attention, rightfully so. And so I am of the opinion that it is a statistical anomaly. But whatever it is, we need to be darn sure that we put the brakes on it.
Well, to that end, the FAA held a safety summit. You co-moderated it. It seems like there haven't been as many incidents in the last few months. Maybe, you know, one or two have popped up, but it seems like maybe that rash has left us behind. Do you think the industry did get a little bit of a wake-up call there and maybe we're starting to pay attention, or we did a little bit of retraining? You think that was helpful, at least to shine a spotlight on it?
Well, I think if you look at the results that you just mentioned, you are right. That safety summit was, I think, March 15th. And so you're right. Things have settled down a little bit. So I hope that has helped put the spotlight on this, and people are kind of getting back to basics. And I think that was the premise of the article that you're referencing, is that, guys, it's time to get back to basics. And let's observe the sterile cockpit rule. Let's actively monitor where the airplane is taxiing or flying. So I think that if there's any Band-Aid solution or underlying solution, I think that's always important to get back to basics. I'm not necessarily a sports fan, but they talk about you got to get back to basics occasionally. And I wish my South Carolina Gamecocks would get back to basics and start winning some football games right now.
You mentioned your role at Embry-Riddle, where you're surrounded by the next generation of airline pilots in many ways. So what's a non-obvious skill you think airline pilots of tomorrow will need? Obviously, things we've talked about, professionalism, sterile cockpit, you'd like them all to be great stick and rudder pilots. But what's something that maybe the average student these days hasn't thought of that you'd like to impress upon them?
Well, as mentioned, I did speak yesterday to two classes on professionalism, and I'll do it again tonight. I think that's a message that always has to be emphasized. It was sort of odd that I was talking about early accidents that I had been involved with at the NTSB, starting with the Comair crash in August of 06, and was talking about several accidents that happened, you know, in the latter half from starting with accidents that happened in 04, going up to Colgan Air in 2009, and maybe one other one that was in 2014. And it occurred to me that these students, if they are 18 years old, they may not have even been born when some of these crashes occurred. So the message I tried to emphasize is that the old saying of, those who don't remember the past are condemned to repeat it, that you've got to learn from these accidents to remember how things happened. And I think that sort of helped me as I was coming along, is unfortunately there were several crashes along the way that while I was learning to fly. I started flying in January of 74, and in September of 74, there was an Eastern Airlines crash in Charlotte. And the big deal that it came out in the papers, and my home is in South Carolina, this accident happened in Charlotte. And so it was all over the news when it happened. And the thing that really struck with me is the fact that these pilots were talking about everything else other than flying the airplane as they flew it into the ground. So I think that might be why I have a hyper awareness of the need for the sterile cockpit rule.
Yeah, what an excellent point that there's a whole generation that, because of the success of the airlines and their safety programs, really hasn't experienced major airline accidents. I know as I was learning to fly, I could name the landmark TWA-800 you mentioned, American 965, Value Jet, these major news stories that as a pilot, you couldn't help but notice and take to heart a little bit of, my gosh, if those professionals can do it, maybe I can do it too. And I need to be on my game. So excellent point. Robert, we always like to close with our Ready to Copy segment. This is a series of rapid-fire questions on a wide variety of topics, aviation and non-aviation. So are you ready to copy?
I've got my pencil ready.
Speaking of landmark accidents, is there one that sticks in your mind as a defining one in aviation safety history where the industry really changed afterwards? You mentioned TWA-800, which is in many ways the accident investigation to end all accident investigations. Is there another one that sticks out to you?
Absolutely. There's two of them. One, June 30th, 1956, mid-air collision over the Grand Canyon. That led to, 128 lives. That led to the reform of our air traffic control system. and the positive control of aircraft under IFR clearances. And it led to the formation of the FAA through the, I think, 1958 or 1959 is when the FAA was formed. As a result of that crash, when I was young, I always heard that the day I was born was associated with a major airline crash, and it was that midair. That was the day I was born. So, I think that one always sticks out. As a side note, I want to make sure that the day I leave this earth is not also associated with an airplane crash.
It's an excellent goal.
Certainly that one stands out just because, it was the day I was born, but such reform occurred as a result of that crash. The next one, and we'd like to think, and there have been safety improvements all along the way as a result of crashes, but I would say that Colgan Air was a watershed accident in that so many reforms came out as a result of that. Now, for the listeners, we know that was February the 12th of 2009 in approaching Buffalo. But look what's happened as a result of that from an air carrier perspective. An entire new set of regulations regarding flight and duty time were put in place as a result of that. The way that pilots are fundamentally hired, trained, and maintained qualifications has resulted in that. We have the 1,500-hour rule, as controversial as that may be in the eyes of some, that came as a result of that. So I think that was a watershed accident. And I just realized this is supposed to be a lightning round, and I'm taking too much time answering the question.
I asked the former chairman of the NTSB about landmark accidents, so I should expect a long answer. Those are obviously very important accidents and worth reading into if listeners have not read into those. What gets your vote for the most important safety technology invention of the last 25 years? GPS, data link weather, autopilots, ground procs, warning systems, a lot of things have come along. Which one has made the biggest impact, do you think?
Without a doubt, the enhanced ground proximity warning system developed by the late Don Bateman, who, of course, we lost earlier this year, it has prevented so many control flight into terrain accidents and air carrier. Not only the air carrier world, but, I look at Boeing data from the early 2000s where CFIT, control flight into terrain, was right up there with loss of control in flight in terms of the number of fatalities. And I look at the data from now, CFIT has been driven down significantly as a result of this highly important flight safety tool.
Yeah, maybe somehow even overlooked to this day. It's just CFIT is not a topic of conversation as much in the airline world because we almost solved that problem, which is amazing. You spent 8 years consulting on NASA's aviation safety reporting system. You mentioned this earlier, the NASA reports that many of us read and occasionally file, perhaps. What's a lesson you learned reading those reports? Is there some through line that connects many of those reports?
I think the ability of pilots to sort of confess their sins and say, I screwed up, here's why, and here's what I will do in the future to prevent it. I think that there's a lot of learning potential coming out of that. And what I would do on contract for the NASA ASRS would be to grab 300 reports and say, I want to learn everything we can about altitude deviations and start going through those and then putting things in buckets. Well, this was a result of inadequate flight crew monitoring. This was a result of pilots not hearing what the controller had assigned. This was a result of whatever. And so I think, as a result of that, we put in place at my airline an altitude awareness program because we learned what the problems were. And then that program has basically been replicated by airlines across the world.
Yeah, NASA has a great callback email newsletter. You can get a sort of digest version of recent reports. Great reading for GA pilots if you're not subscribed. You had one of my favorite quotes in recent aviation history. You described the NOTAM system as, quote, a bunch of garbage that nobody pays any attention to. A characterization that few pilots could disagree with, certainly when you're going into Big City International and you see 47 NOTAMs for every taxiway and ramp closure. There's been some progress on this maybe over the last few years, but it's still largely the same system it is. So if you had to give the NOTAM system a grade right now in 2023, what would it be?
Well, I think there's still too many NOTAMs that are too difficult to read. And so I think that they need to be relevant to the flight. So I do applaud the FAA for and ICAO for making progress on this. I'm going to say a C, but a lot of progress needs to be made.
What's the biggest difference in the airline world of today compared to when you started your career? What's something that a new airline pilot will experience or deal with that you never even contemplated?
Yeah, when I started, many, many airline pilots would spend years sitting on the flight engineers panel. Nowadays, guys can be a direct entry pilot sitting right in the right seat of a Boeing 757, 767. So they've got the opportunity to jump right in there and trial by fire. I had the advantage of sitting on the panel for a year watching how an airline operates. And so I learned a lot just sitting there watching and doing my job back behind the first officer with all these switches and dials. But nowadays, they don't have that opportunity. They've got to figure it out as soon as they get on the line. So I think that's a one change right there.
From a purely safety standpoint, are single pilot airliners a good idea?
Well, I'll leave that to others to determine. You know, I think eventually, and it won't be in my lifetime, but you know, eventually we will probably have fully autonomous airliners, not in the next few years, but you know, they can send a rocket to the moon. It is manned. Well, some of us are not manned, I guess, but or crewed. But you know, I'm staying out of that fight.
It'll be an interesting challenge for the NTSB when the first uncrewed aircraft crashes, and we've got to determine probable cause, won't it?
It will be. Yes.
You've worked with CBS News as a safety analyst, a thankless job in many cases, where you're called in to try to make sense of something with few facts. But what's your advice for a regular pilot who might go on the local news or talk to a newspaper reporter? Sometimes this happens in the aftermath of an accident. What are some do's and don'ts for the regular pilot to remember?
I would say don't speculate. And, you know, I have had to go from my role at the NTSB for 15 years of not speculating. And now that I'm with CBS News, they want answers and they want to lure me into speculating. So it's hard not to do. I know we were all extremely saddened to see the death of Richard McSpadden a few weeks ago. And I always felt like Richard did such a good job in his I think it was called early analysis, mm-hmm. Whatever it was. He did such an extraordinary job in front of the camera, just sitting there explaining the facts and not getting out there with a bunch of speculation. We certainly will miss Richard in everything that he has done to promote aviation safety.
Absolutely. He was one of the best. Robert, we always like to go outside of aviation for our last couple of questions, so we'll try to put you on the spot here. I've seen some pictures of you driving a Porsche Boxster, so I need to know what airplane is most like that sports car?
Oh, wow. I don't know, because I never really flew any really high-performance airplanes. I'm stuck to the airline world, and so I can't compare my Boxster to an airplane. So that's a really good one. As I put the top down in a few hours and drive to campus, I'll try and think about that.
I was going to say maybe a Decathlon or an extra 300 or something small, but sporty with lots of good handling characteristics. So you'll have to let me know. All right. You mentioned you're a native of South Carolina, a place famous for its food, at least in my opinion, some of the best food in the United States. Shrimp and grits, pimento cheese, you name it. Do you have a favorite that next time we're all in the Palmetto State, we need to make sure we try?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned it. I had shrimp and grits on Saturday night, in fact. And so I think that's you can never go wrong with that, unless you're allergic to seafood. But hey, you could leave the shrimp off and just eat the grits.
You mentioned your South Carolina Gamecocks. The South Carolina-Clemson rivalry, underrated in my opinion. People talk about Ohio State, Michigan, or Duke, UNC. South Carolina Clemson shuts down the state, it feels like, when it happens. Can you describe that rivalry in a few words?
Well, it is a huge rivalry. And of course, I would not want to mention that South Carolina upset Clemson last year. It was a heck of a game. There's houses divided where one family member is going to Clemson and one has gone to Carolina. So it's quite a rivalry there. And so this year will be interesting. Neither team is having the best year they've ever had. So we'll see how it goes.
Our last question is always the same on Pilot's Discretion. You have one final flight. We want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
Right now, I'm just flying that Porsche Boxster. And so I'm not current, I'm not exactly proud of that, but I just don't have the time to go out and do it the way that I want to do it. So I'm just not even current. But do I always look upward when something flies by? You bet I do.
Robert, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
John, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.